name is Jessica Kelly. My home group is Jerry. It's on Tuesday nights in Denver. You're all invited. It's a very good meeting. It's the Step Study Group. I want you to know, out of that 75 years, of course, we know Lorraine has many more than I do. I want to thank the committee and everyone else who had anything to do with my coming here. It was a lovely drive from Denver, and it's wonderful. You know, Kansas is a pretty state, awful to say. If you just drive 7 days to the desert, but once you get off into these towns, often understand it's beautiful here. I'm always surprised at how lovely the country is when you can really feel it. It's still the state almost everywhere, but it's the ugliest part of the state and the cities are on the interstate, and it's just pretty coming in here. And it's green. And, you know, I have to tell you, in Denver, we envy anything that's green because we haven't seen any water fall out of the sky for a very long time, and we're very brown and sere, and we look like it was maybe late August, and it's only September, so expect bread prices to go up. We need time if you're in trouble. The 25th of March, 1966, I came into Al-Anon, and by the strength of good sponsorship, the grace of God, and a commitment to the steps of this program, I have not found it necessary to take any adorable little drunks home with me, milk and chicken soup, and lend the money since that time. That's not the only freedom that this program has given me, but it's certainly one of the best. Lots of things have happened in my life since that day. Some of them very lovely, some of them less lovely, because life happens whether you belong in the program or you don't, and you survive it if you belong in it. You're better than survive it. You surmount it if you have the program to help you. One of the wonderful parts of the program happened to me just a little better than a month ago. When my father was a boy, the United States currency was based on gold, and sometime, I don't know when, but sometime a long time ago, we went off the gold standard, and everyone who had gold coins was supposed to turn them in. I guess they stacked them up in Fort Knox. I don't know what they did with them. But my dad held out some gold coins. And they came and after his death into my possession, and I've been giving them away little by little over a number of years. And the 30th of last April, I got to give my one of my sons here a $25 gold coin to celebrate his 25th year in AA. I know you know that I'm too young to be his mother, but I'm married very young. I grew up in New England. I am not a victim of geography, and I have come to believe that a lot of what I thought was New England was really the time and not the place, because I talk sometimes with people from the Deep South who were brought up almost under the same kind of strict regimen and strict rules that applied to everything. When to wear white before Memorial Day, good heavens, especially not white shoes. All kinds of rules that applied. I broke most of them as quickly as I could. I did my very best to break them as fast as they were told to me. But there are some rules that you don't break that I wouldn't ever have dared to break, because those are the big rules. Those are the heavy duty stuff that applies to life with capital letters. In my particular family, one of the rules was that we are never beholden to anyone. We do not accept favors. We pay them back promptly. We have emergency Christmas presents in our family. That's something you got last year, and it was either a duplicate or something you already had, or you really didn't like it much. So you put it in a drawer and saved it, and as soon as unexpected gave you a Christmas present, you quickly wrap that up in the paper you saved from last year, too. Now, if you iron it on a very low iron between two pieces of wax tape, it's as good as new. And you would wrap that then and give it to the new person who gave us a present that they weren't expecting, so they wouldn't be beholden, so they wouldn't be indebted. And the other thing, of course, is that you have to keep secrets. Family secrets are not discussed outside of the family. We simply do not. We do not do that. I got married when I was 17. My mother died almost 40 years later, and I hadn't gotten around to telling her yet. I am very good at keeping secrets. I was married in high school, and it was wartime, and my new husband was killed in the war 6 weeks after we were married, and so there was really no reason for me to tell my mother. She didn't need to know. She said, if you would have, I would have said, all the day that you say that the man I'm living with happens to be my husband, because in New England in the 1930s, you sort of got married and had children in that order. And my mother's family, definitely in that order. We were sort of afraid of our mothers, our clergy person, and God in that order also. I have a birth certificate that says I was born in Kansas, but my mother says I was not, and I figure she probably knew more about it than they did. My father was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas when I was born, and I think at that time your father was the head of the house, and where he was is where we were born, too bad. I was born in Boston, and I was the 12th generation of my mother's family to have been born in the same place. And we were very proud of that. It was very, very big thing to be old New England family. We were old and poor. We were, in New England, it's sort of called being well-endowed and family, a well-endowed family, which means you have a negative cash flow but impeccable ancestors. I didn't live there. I went to first grade in Fort Riley, Kansas. I went to second grade in Fort Riley, Kansas, and first grade in Turkey, and I have not yet recovered from the culture shock. My dad was attached to the service, and we moved very often. I grew up in a nice family. I wish I had a good excuse for what happened to the rest of my life, but my family would not have provided that. My parents, we would have called it mushy. We were not mushy. We didn't say we loved each other. We didn't hold each other. We didn't hug a lot. There was not a lot of physical contact. But at the base of all that, I knew very well that I was very well loved. I never doubted that my parents loved me. And I grew up in a family where everybody drank. Everybody drank. Babies drank. Because you soaked the baby's nipple when it was teething. You soaked the baby's nipple in brandy, which was a lot more classy than the hospitals were doing. They soaked baby's nipples in whiskey. And that was the standard treatment for little babies in distress across the country until maybe 15 years ago. No one in my family that I have ever found or know about abused alcohol. All of us drank moderately. We drank wine with meals. We drank beer on hot days. We drank brandy at night, in cold nights, and to the best of my knowledge, no one in my family abused alcohol. So when I met alcohol and alcoholism, I didn't know what it was. I had no clue what that was all about. I married when I was 17, and I was quickly widowed. Went on to college, did well, and had a wonderful time. But, you know, in the culture that I grew up in, for women, Although my dad was extremely supportive and told me I could be president of General Motors of the United States if I really wanted to, when I was a kid, I really wanted to be shortstop for the New York Yankees. But when I stopped going at this height, getting a job with the New York Yankees got pretty remote possibility. I want a shortstop. Why not? The culture, the attitude was that if you were a woman, maybe you could be a president of General Motors, but then you should be like a mother. You would certainly be more fulfilled. You would be a happier person if you were a wife and mother than if you were anything else. And I was all of 20, and I wasn't a wife or a mother. I finished school a year early. I was a good student and finished in a four-year course in three. And then I looked around to see why I still didn't feel fulfilled, and it seemed to me that what I needed was a husband and children. So I began interviewing people for the position of a chief husband. Really not as many applicants as you might suppose. But there was this one man who was so interesting. You know, I grew up in a house where things were, well, we sort of cleaned things before they got dirty, and we fixed things about a week before they broke, and things went along smoothly and automatically and were very pleasant, and I was very bored. I wanted life to be much more exciting than that. I wanted to go where the lights were low and the music was slow, and they were not. And when I got out of school, I started looking for a replacement. I looked for somebody who was colorful. And you know, the man I chose to marry came from a very colorful family. The first time I was taken home to meet his family, Papa wasn't there. And the reason Papa wasn't there was because Papa was in jail. Now, I never met anybody who went to jail. Never in my entire life at that point had I ever met anyone who went to jail. But they quickly explained to me that freedom is for hard cases, but you can go to jail just because the police have no sense of humor. And Papa would be with us again shortly, and everything would go on normally. And you know, they yelled at each other, and in our house we never raised our voices. I don't mean we were never angry. We were angry cold. You could sort of sit in our living room and see the ice form along the wall sometimes, but we did not raise our voices. We did not yell. We did not scream. We did not throw things. They did all of the above. It was fascinating to watch, and I could hardly wait to get to this great party that they were all having. So 6 weeks after I met him, I married him. In that family, it was almost two distinct families, but there were two great differences. Everyone in that family either drank excessively or not at all. There were no normal drinkers like my family. We knew how to drink. They didn't know anything about it. They either did it at all, or they just got fallen down drunk. I didn't quite understand how that went, but I had married one of the chief on the side, so I felt absolutely secure. In fact, I thought it would be pretty good if we loosened up a little and learned to drink socially. What he learned to drink is intermittently, which is quite different from socially. Months would go by, sometimes more than a year, sometimes almost two, sometimes I think once or twice even longer than that, when he was a teetotaler. When he drank, it was a disaster. I remember once he was still in the service, and he went out one afternoon, one Saturday afternoon to play golf, and called 2 days later from Alaska, where he had signed on to be a cook for the hunting party. Things happened when he drank, but he did all. And I had not seen alcoholism. I had no idea what was going on. I have wanted to marry so I could have children. My initial plan was the first I would come to the New York Nations, and then I would get married after my career and have 12 children. It's sort of a time warp, and it's going to happen soon because of all that is. But I did want to have children, and I have maybe a talent for having children because I have 6 little boys before the oldest was 8. I didn't feel fulfilled. I felt overwhelmed, basically. I understand what minorities are like. I was a minority in my house. I have twins, which accounts for some of them, and the twins were very premature. At one time, I had 3 children less than a year. I don't know how you would handle that, but mostly I was tired, and whenever it slowed down, I fell asleep. My children remember a better mother than I remember being, and I think that's because we get to choose our memories, and they have chosen to remember the good parts of our lives and not the bad. Our oldest child was asthmatic, and my husband was out of the service, and we needed to move out of Northern where it was very damp, and he needed to be someplace where the climate was drier. And so we moved to New Mexico. He's from the south. I've heard him a couple of times, and he said the town he came from was so little that the recreation center was a bird bath and a slingshot. And that's about what our town in New Mexico was. It was 40 miles to any place. And even when we got there, it was no place. It was 120 miles to Santa Fe, and that was the nearest city of any size. It was the real world reality. But the twins did us a great favor. In spring in New Mexico, they got to be 13 years old. On their 13th birthday, I had a baby girl. We were going to call her Encore because she wasn't on the initial program. But we didn't. And the twins began to drink. Now, I know if you live in a family where we are all unhappy, and nobody knows exactly why we were unhappy, we were not functioning as a family. We were a group of people who had the same last name and lived in the same house, but family was not what we were. And nobody knew why. And nobody knew what was wrong. But the twins began to drink. And suddenly, we had a cause for all our unhappiness, and it wasn't me, which was a surprise in some ways. And we certainly were, at 13, we were certainly going to blame the twins, the alcoholics, for everything that was wrong in our family. They were the cause of it. You know, my career, if you can have a career in spring, New Mexico, was not doing well. We had bought the newspaper there that we were running, and it was not doing well. And all of that was because we were so concerned about the twins. They were the cause of everything that was wrong in our family. The rest of the kids were not doing well in spring schools. It's hard not to do well in spring schools because the curve is in your favor. But that was because they were embarrassed and disgusted by their brother's conduct, and the twins were to blame for everything. The next day was circling the drain, and it certainly flushed itself down there rather quickly, and we moved. We had no money, and we had one child with exceptional IQ, and we moved to Denver in part because they had accelerated classes in Denver for really bright kids, and that was the best I could do for him under the circumstances financially, and was getting into accelerated classes. And partly because they promised us we would get a baseball team was imminent. Took 30 years for it to emerge, but we didn't have one this year. We should have had some kind of little road in and out of being really baseball teams, but with good children reasons like that, we moved up to Denver, and I was kind to the twins for about 2 weeks. because the population of the high school that they were attending was greater than the entire town that they came from. So I was willing to give them a little credit for an adjustment period. They were over-adjusted very soon. And I had another bright idea. In spring, I had one good idea, because I came from a family who knew how to drink. My husband's family obviously didn't know how to drink. They didn't know how to enjoy alcohol. And once I could teach the twins how to do that, everything would be just fine. So I undertook, we had not had alcohol in the house very often or very much, because somehow it just didn't seem to go with what life was like. But I started buying alcohol, buying wine, I bought glasses, I taught the twins how to drink. I taught them that white wine goes with fish and red wine goes with meat, and they drank white wine with fish and without fish. You know, I thought I would make it too expensive for them to drink, and I bought the very best French brandy and the correct glasses to drink it out of, and I taught them how to pour it down the side so it didn't bruise, how to hold the glass so you held it at the right temperature at all times, held it this way in your hand and turned it very slowly so that the brandy would stay at skin temperature. I taught them that you hold the glass in front of your mouth and inhale the aroma before you begin to drink, and that it takes about an hour and a half to drink an ounce and a half. Now, if this is your first time to at program, if you're brand new and you have somebody at your house who's very concerned about the temperature and is taking an hour and a half to drink an ounce and a half, you can go to Weight Watchers or Bird Watchers or anything you want to, because what you have at your house is not alcoholism. You don't have to come here and do all this hard work that's involved in this program. My next good idea when I got to Denver was that they should join the Navy. I have no idea why I thought getting into the service was good for alcoholics. Well, it is good for alcoholics, it's just not good for getting over alcoholics. So the Navy had a thing called the Kitty Cruise, and you could, boys could go in at 16 and come out, I think it was at 20, maybe 21, with credits for college and with their high school diploma, which they could get while they were in the service, and come out ready for college. Well, I told them either they get at least B's or they get their enlistment papers, and they got their enlistment papers. Didn't work the way I had planned for it to. I had a couple of kiddies cruising in the South Pacific very soon. But, Chuck, the twin who just celebrated his 25th birthday in AA, his 25th anniversary in AA, he managed to complete his enlistment. He came to re-enlist, but his commanding officer would not let him re-enlist. Then he got sent home. I got a letter. It said, I don't know what it said actually, but when I read it, it said, "We are sending Danny home because he's too drunk to be a drunken sailor." And that's going to be kind of drunk. And I was desperate. I was absolutely desperate. Because my mother was, part of this is because my mother was a regional member of Planned Parenthood. She did not think my behavior was at all amusing, and she was quite sure that big families ended up in penitentiaries. And I was not really able to totally dismiss that, because I had the kind of kids that other mothers told their children not to play with. And so I figured when Danny came home, he would be the catalyst. He would be the catalyst that landed the rest of them in the penitentiary. and I was truly desperate for what to do. So I went to congressmen. I come from a very politically active family. I probably know who your congressman is even now. I wrote to all of them that I ever heard of, and they all wrote back. The little politicians write to you. You know, like two pages single spaced, and all it said was, no, we can't help. The rest of it was just talk, just occupied space. So I was truly desperate. I did the thing that any political-minded American mother would do. I called the President of the United States. It is not difficult. If a list of humor, you can get it from information. It's not difficult to call the President. It's difficult to get the President, but it's not difficult to get the phone. At that time, in the 60s, you could call the operator and just tell her to keep ringing the White House and bring back when you reach someone. I didn't do that because I did get someone. I got a switchboard operator, and that woman is cold. I thought maybe I'd get Lady Bird, and she'd say, well, I'll have Lyndon take care of it, so when she comes here, walking the dog. I did not get any member of the President's family. I don't think I got anybody who ever actually saw the President. I got cut off right there at the switchboard. And so I was truly desperate. We no longer have a newspaper of any kind, but I always say the suburb of Denver and Aurora would truly probably tar and feather me if I called Aurora a suburb, but it was the town immediately east of Denver. They had a weekly newspaper, had little ads and about this size, you know, lost cats and stray dogs, and one of them said, do you have a problem with alcoholism? And I landed on that firmly, because I had a problem with alcoholism. And I called a crazy person. I called the person out at Alcoholics Anonymous, who obviously was crazy, because in the first place he answered the phone and he said his name and he said, I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholism is not something that you talk about outside the family. I certainly knew that. No one says, hi, my name's Jill, I'm an alcoholic. Good heavens. But I was desperate. What else am I going to do? So I told him my little story. I said I had a genuine government-certified alcoholic. He was coming home on Tuesday, and I wanted someone from AA to go to the airport with me and get it. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't do that. I explained to him that he needed the membership to grow, he really ought to start keeping it. Lots of people have these alcoholics running around, but they would not be glad to have a platform. I explained also that I work 3 to 11, my husband works a regular 9 to 5 shift. We didn't need a permanent person from AA. We just needed somebody to stay with him for a few hours while we worked and got some sleep. And we would be willing to pay a reasonable price for this. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't do that. What did he do? And he said something else to me. Now, I want you to understand what's going on here. I work 311. I have a degree with 6 or 7 kids living in my house. I have an office in my professional society. I get good evaluations. I get raises. I get promotions. I start dinner before I leave it. So I get trained so that my husband and the kids come home. This was the year that the kids went in starched chanel pants And my boys had starched chino pants that looked as good as anybody's. I was holding this whole family together in the palm of my hand, and this crazy person at Alcoholics Anonymous said to me, "Perhaps you're sick." I said, "Excuse me?" But you know, I found out the situation, and I had kind of thought. I had not made myself clear in some things that I had said to him, and I knew that he assumed that I was the alcoholic and I had just made up the story. And he confirmed that. He said he did have his wife call me. And that, obviously, he had made that mistake because as an alcoholic man, he can't come to my house and go through my underwear drawer looking for nips, who can't pat me down and see where my bottle is. He has to send a woman to do this kind of thing. Well, I'll do it. And he said he may have to call. And so there I am. I'm in a really bad spot because I am beholden to this man, crazy though he may be. I have taken up his time. He has not accepted any money, so I am indebted to him, and I have to do something to cancel the debt. So when he said his wife would call, I agreed. Okay, let her call. And I gave him my phone number and let her call. I had this clear vision. I just finally gotten to nice middle class suburb out in the non-suburb, and think what it's going to look like. I'm living in the neighborhood, she's in the neighborhood, and there's going to be this big white station wagon in front of my house with layers on the side, Alcoholics Anonymous, watching. This is not good, but I am committed. I am stuck with this. His wife called me. I have no idea what she said to me. But I talked to her. Now, I talk to everybody. I talk about the Rockies. I talk about sports. I talk about the wind always blowing campus. I chat with people. I have a good time doing that. That's not what I'm talking about. I talked to her. I told her that I felt alone and afraid and ashamed in my own house, that I didn't know how I was a failure, basically what I told her. And now I was in worse trouble than ever. Because I probably took up 40 minutes of this woman's time just telling her how terrible my life is. I have broken the rule about secrecy, and I am again indebted. So when she said that I needed to go to a meeting, I agreed. Because I thought, think of it some kind of prize for bringing in the most people. So yes, places, fish towels, whatever they're giving. And I'm out of it. And nobody will ever have to know that I told the secrets of my family to strangers. So I agreed to go. And I went. She didn't have a big white station wagon. She had a canary yellow Cadillac, which was almost as conspicuous. But at least it didn't have any writing on the side. And I went to the first meeting with her. And I walked in that room to what I thought was an admission of failure, that I was not a good wife, that I was not a good mother, that I was admitting failure by even walking into this room, which would be full of, there was a bar called the Loser's Lounge in Aurora, and I think of the losers were drinking in the bar and their wives were sitting in the room. And it was just going to be a complaining cry about how terrible life was. And I'm trying to learn what. And you know, it's obvious to me that everybody had been sober in their family for many years because they were just acting like normal people. And it was the 60s. Remember the 60s? No, you don't remember the 60s. Those of you who saw American Graffiti, in the 60s, women had purple hair, largely, and it was piled on their head from beehives, and it was shellacked or varnished or something. Absolutely not one hair grazed on those heads. I walked into a room where a woman with varnished purple hair, and I did not feel that I had come to my spiritual home. But I got company later on that I had never seen before. Now, I am certain my family loved me, and I went to church and heard about a God that loved me. I didn't care much for him. He was too bossy. He had a lot of defects of character. I decided that I could get along quite well without him very early in my life, and I had put him aside. He was always angry, lived in that little gold box in the back of the church, and on Sunday morning they took him out of the little gold box, and he was always mad about stuff. It was not man's humanity, it wasn't the man who took to man that he was mad about. He was mad about things like you weren't supposed to have a hat on and you were not supposed to wear sandals and you've been moving the wrong stuff on the wrong days and not too good, and he's just not worth God giving as much. But I had been exposed to God that loved me. I knew that my parents loved me. But inside myself, although I don't think anyone ever told me this, I felt that I was loved conditionally. That God loved me as long as I kept this long list of prohibitions and rules and regulations, that I certainly would be loved better if I kept my name cleaner, if I did things that I needed to earn love. And I walked in that room and those women loved me. I don't really understand any of that now and on. I hope you do. I was so shocked to hear a woman in my home group, a new woman, say that she did not feel loved in her group, that I was speechless. Because I had no idea what that meeting was about. It could have been Swahili for all I know. I just knew I walked into that room into a place of safety and acceptance. And I hope it's working in that. I have great doubts about it, but I hope that there are some groups that are offering what was offered to me, safety and acceptance in that room. And I went for a long time. I just went on Tuesday afternoons, just before I went to work, because it was such a safe place, and I was accepted there. I had no idea that I was sick and should get well. I had no idea that I should do anything except sit in that room and feel good. For 1 hour a week, I felt good. I felt good in that meeting. Then I came home and decided to join Alcoholics Anonymous. He was very fortunate. I had some time off from my surgery, and then he didn't have a driver's license. I joined with Bernie coming here sober, and believe me, it's a spiritual experience. But I was able to take him to meetings and, you know, give him the elbow when they said things that were particularly important to him, and explain to him on the way home the things that he knew. 19, he's just a kid. He needed some guidance, and then you guys just didn't seem to do a lot of that explaining that he needed. And so I could explain to him the little nuances and the sincerity of AA. But you know, Ben wanted sobriety so much that he got sober anyway. And he got something more than sobriety. Sobriety is the absence of alcohol. Excuse me. Then he got something that was not a subtraction, it was an addition. You know, and all sobriety is miraculous, in my opinion. But AA sobriety, which is added to spirituality and to serenity, so the only way I can describe it is to put a light behind the eyes. And the light came on behind Bernie's eyes. I don't mean that he went to 60 meetings in 60 days when he was measured for halo and rings, but something changed. And I liked the change, and I wanted the change. And so I asked Bernie how to get it, and he said, well, you know, we have to drink more or get it in marijuana. I've been drunk a couple times in my life. I can't imagine why anybody would do it. It would be completely horrible. So I decided I would get it in Al-Anon. I got what we call the temporary sponsor. And we still have temporary sponsors in my home group, which is someone until you understand enough about what you're doing to ask for a sponsor who will work steps with you and help you with programs, but just somebody that you can talk to and who will tell you how to behave in their own meeting. I have no idea. I was waiting my chance to tell them how terrible it was most of the time. I got a temporary sponsor. I didn't wish it was temporary. Somebody forgot to tell me that. Or I just didn't listen to it when they did. I kept it for 20 years. I kept it for a while. Finally, she took it away from me. And after a while, she didn't know who I was, and she didn't know who her children were, and finally, she didn't know who she was. And that was the reason that I ever replaced her. I would have her today if she were able to do this. I have another sponsor. I've only had two. One woman has 400 pound mouth and no jacks. And they were exactly what I needed. They were exactly what I needed. The first one, I think she gave me the steps, or they were just hanging on the wall. She said I would have to do them. So I decided I would. I was doing one so far to me. All the ones that are about high power and God were certainly out because I wouldn't believe in that. So I thought I would do 4 and 12, 4, 5, and 12. And so I wrote a beautiful first step. It was the only paper in any college in this country. It was punctuated correctly, it was indented correctly, it had straight margins. It was an excellent paper. And I called her and asked her if I could come to her house and read it to her. And she agreed to let me. And then when I got to her house, she said, how did you get to the first step? And I said, I didn't get there. I started there. She said, they number them for people like you who can't tell where to start. I said, excuse me, I have 2 master's degrees and you did not finish high school and I don't have to take anything off you. She said, that's right, you don't. Thank you for coming to my house and sharing with me the peace and serenity that permeate your life. I never would like a response. We started over again and we have control. The first step is, okay, that's why I'm here. It's because I'm powerless over alcohol. I came here for you to give me the power. And we spent kind of a long time on the first step, which was kind of a short time compared to what we spent on the second step. It says, a power greater than myself, and it says, restore to sanity. Excuse me, I am not the crazy person in this situation. We have spent a very long time on very few phrases, but we got through them. And after that, we got through the rest of the steps. And I worked them very hard. My sponsor started me off in the service work by saying, we're going to start a Monday morning meeting because I don't go to website training. She said, there's lots of people that need a Monday morning meeting after the horror of the weekend. So we're going to start a Monday morning meeting and we're going to do the GR. I said, how do you know that? After I said, what's the GR? I said, is it like this? Well, yes, it is, but don't worry about that. And I didn't worry about it. When I got to the GR, I went to, at that time, there were four districts in Denver, and they met at North Street. And I went down there, and, that was the weirdest thing that ever happened to me in Al-Anon. I got in that room, and before the last amen had stopped echoing in that room, the first started to fly. Those women just knew they went at it. And I am not colorway, and I haven't stood a mouth with anybody, but I was kind of hiding behind the curtains because it was getting up heavy in there. their arms around each other and say, I'm sorry. It wasn't how I was accustomed to hierarchy working, and it wasn't a hierarchy. And I took it a long time to understand what it was. I went to the DR after that. I've been state chairman, twice I've been alternate delegate. Right now, what I'm doing is working at the information service half a day a week and sponsoring event with people and doing what I did when I was new, because I've had on platforms like this for 20 years. It's a wonderful place. If you're new, try to get on a platform, because you will never find friends again anywhere in your life like the ones you will meet doing service work in Al-Anon. I sat there for 20 years, but if I continue sitting there, nobody else can. So it's time that I got down off the platform and did some of the gut work, the hard work, again, that I did when I came in. So I'm back being a sponsor, taking my turn, being chairperson at my home meetings, being a member of Al-Anon, which is the highest office in the land. There's a phrase and code at Al-Anon that I have been so grateful for all my life. It says there is no sorrow too great to be lessened. And it became very important in my life. When my little girl was 16, she preferred charges of rape and incest against her father. I did what we taught me to do here. I called my sponsor. I went to the police station and stayed with her while the questioning went on, while the whole thing went on. And I called my sponsor, who had asked me to come to her house at that time. She lived across the city from me. She said, can we drive the car? I said, well, we're not very cool. I can handle emergencies. I drove the car. I think they dabbled me because they put on all the lights on the outside of their house and were standing in plain view in case I missed it, I guess. Me and my daughter and I went in their house, and they did what sponsors do and what you do everywhere. We put my daughter to bed in their bedroom. They treated her as if she were a queen. I had said for years that they told her it would be all right, and my daughter recently heard me and said, no, they didn't. They never said it would be all right. He isn't all right yet. He probably never will be all right. What they said was that I would be all right. They told her that she would be all right, and they worked with her a long time, helping her to be all right. I was one of their house guests. I was so angry. I cannot tell you how angry I was, because there are many words in the English language to tell you how angry I was. My sponsor had one of those, you have them here. You have them over here. They're in AA. They're about 5 feet on the outside, and they're about, seven foot 11 on the inside. They have no idea there's a hand reaching out for help. They should ask me if something attached to an alcoholic. If the hand reaches out, they reach out. They hit little old beaten-up pickups, and they go driving their little pickups to the edge of the lake where they think they're in trouble. And they slide them all over, and they grab their leg out and come out after you, and they stick them in the water, and they reach in and look before they come in. Her husband had written a big book where it says you should pray for the person against whom you have an anger, and you should do it for 2 weeks, and that's what I should do. I probably wouldn't have listened to him because he's just a drunk, just so you know. But my sponsor said I should do that, and so I listened to that, and I tried to do it, and I couldn't do it. I could not do it. I can pray God damn him. And I certainly meant that as a prayer, and that's what I wanted to have happen. It was not irreverent, or irrelevant either. It was exactly what I was praying for. It took me a long time, but no one in Al-Anon has ever told me to do anything that they have not shown me how to do. And so my sponsor and little husband and done things with other people. He came to my house, took me to meetings, talked to me, showed me how to be able to do that. Did not link me with a feeling of how to do that. He showed me the way to do that. And they told me about their experiences in doing it. I was very important. You can't bring that back into the house with your child, at least I couldn't. My daughter did well, fairly well, quite well. When we had been divorced about 3 years, my ex-husband had lung cancer. Obviously, terminal had passed, so we wanted to go and see our sons that were now living in California, and I was able to take him. With airlines, we let him fly without, they called it medical support, and it happens that I was a nurse, so I need the qualification to be medical support. And I was able to take him. Now, I didn't do that because I'm a good person. I didn't do that because I'm a spiritual giant. I did it because I came here and you taught me. You taught me how to be able to do that. I took him to California, left him in our kids, and in 2 weeks I went back and got him home again, and within 2 weeks after that, he died, and I was surprised to find that I grieved for him. I knew the little guy had wonderful eyebrows. He had great eyebrows. And I knew the little Irish guy with great eyebrows would never have wanted his life to go where it had gone. And I was able to grieve. I knew I could never love him again the way a man ought to be loved by a wife, but I could love him as another child of God and a man with many desperate sicknesses. My ex-husband had been dead less than a year when my youngest son sat in his pickup truck not far from home and didn't get off. I cannot tell you how long ago I was because English language does not allow me to. I was angry with Michael. I was angry with God. I was angry with the program. I was angry. I was just angry. I don't know exactly what I was angry with God, certainly. And I called my sponsor and told her what had happened because that's what she taught me to do. And we worked for a long time on the concept of God that would suit me. And I thought I had it. I truly thought I had it. And then I was living in the Midwest with my sister, and my little son put a rope around his neck and jumped to his death. I was angry. I was really angry because that's what I always am first. I'm angry. I called my sponsor. I came home and picked up the phone, called my sponsor, and put down my suitcase later. I got to her as quickly as I could because that's what she taught me to do. My sponsor is the sponsor. Now is the sponsor I had then. She did what sponsors do because I need to be told clearly in English. And when God makes a voice that can speak to me and can speak the language that I understand, I hear it from my sponsor. I'm not getting any dreams from all of you. I told my sponsor when it happened. I said, when this is over, I'm going to do it without the first step. Because I'm sick and tired of turning my children over to God and having him take them away from me. And Paul said, look, oh, God does not take your children. God receives your children. This is a small difference. It's a major difference. God received my child. He did not take my children. And with that, I can continue to live and to have a productive life. I put Colorado State Chairman after that. I have continued to do everything that you told me to do in the program. My life is very different and very otherwise. I'm not sitting on platforms anymore, but I'm still doing the program and I'm still having the program done to me. I'm a daughter who really should be sitting somewhere in a state institution talking to herself. Who's absolutely expiring in the month you can meet. She has a daughter who almost made it to the insurance one time and has sort of slid up there again. She has two grandchildren that she's helping bring out. She has a loan business. She's a well woman because of this program. I am amazed at her. I'm delighted with her because frankly, if abortion had been safe and legal, when I consented her, I would have her. Which, you know, I wrote that in my book because every once in a while, I'm not sure I remember how small I really am. And I would miss that whole thing with the rest of my own brains. Been with her a long time, Chuck for over 25 years. I've been with her in 34. Life is good, it's not perfect. I had a little discussion with the IRS about my business and gets in swimming. But basically, life is good. Sobriety is a miracle. Recently, it's in many ways a miracle to have survived your childhood and be who she is today. That's a miracle, but that's other people's miracles. So it's not my miracle. My miracle is that I came here without a God and without any hope. And I came to this program where you have given me both. And thank you. Good night.
Thank you.